You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful Davis day. And now it's sort of foggy at times and sunny at times, but it's not raining.
There is very dense fog in some areas. I noticed an alert about an hour or so ago of extremely dense fog up near Woodland, out in the Dixon area where we are. There was very dense fog this morning. And over the last few days, we've had some of that as well as some rain. Lois and I are preparing this show December 18, 2024 for broadcast on December 19. And as we speak late in the morning, it's 50 degrees and overcast at the weather station that this is pulling from, going up to a whopping high today of 53 degrees. And tonight's low will be 40 with dense fog. Thursday, day of the broadcast, dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny and 56 degrees by mid-afternoon. Thursday night, 41 degrees, partly cloudy, then patchy fog. And then we have kind of a break or a little change in the weather. Friday will be patchy fog and 58, warming up a bit. Friday night, 42 degrees and mostly cloudy. And Friday night, late, showers likely. Saturday, 90% chance of showers, 57 degrees. Saturday night, chance of showers, 48 degrees. Sunday, chance of showers, also 58 degrees. Sunday night, showers likely, mainly after 10 p.m. and only going to drop down to 48 degrees. Monday, chance of showers, and Tuesday, showers. And all of those days are going to be 58 degrees, which is pretty darn close to average for this time of year. Those night temperatures are above average. We're looking at 48 degree temperatures. So for those of you who like to track chilling hours for deciduous fruit trees, we have been ahead up until the last few days. We have actually, over the last 6 years, this year's total is the highest except for 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we had a lot of chilling hours. We ended up the year with over 1,200 chilling hours that year. We're on our way. We've got 360 or so chilling hours in the Davis area already, and it's not even the end of December. Most deciduous fruit trees, if you're using the old model for chilling hours, and this is as far as I'm going to go on this topic today, most deciduous fruit trees in this area need, let's say, 700 to 800 chilling hours. Some varieties that home gardeners grow can get by with as few as 600. We are definitely going to reach those numbers this year without any particular problem. And we generally average, for those of you who are new to the area and familiar with the chilling hours concept, we average a little over 800 chilling hours, some years as much as 1,200 or more, last year as little as 600 to 700 in the Davis area, but that was fine for most of the varieties you grow. Bottom line, don't need to be concerned about that this year or at the present time. Looks like we've got bouts of sort of showery weather. We're well ahead on rainfall. Lake Berryessa has risen since November 4 feet and is less than 7 feet from the overflow, and it's not even January. So the reservoirs have lots of water in them. The nearby lake has lots of water in it. We got a lot of rainfall, a lot of water out of just a fairly small number of storms, but they're bringing it in when they do come in. The rainfall totals around Lake Berryessa have been very high. The rainfall totals and snowpack are above average. So good year for water so far. Looking back, I could find many years where we started off great and then went through like the whole month of January without a rainstorm. So practically anything can happen, but we're trending into La Nina, away from El Nino, and that tends to be a drier pattern.
So, Don, I'm going to ask you some technical questions this time. One is, when it says dense fog, mm-hmm. Now, I've heard of tule fog. I've heard of fog on the ocean. I've heard of dense fog. Are they all the same thing? Are they all caused the same way?
No. No, tule fog is the loss of heat from a field or an open area here in the valley. It loses heat to the sky. It drops below the dew point. Water vapor condenses to visible droplets of suspended liquid. That's the kind of fog you get over a field. As I drive in, I can typically see that forming. If I'm early enough, I can see where the fog is forming 4 or 5 feet above an open field, but not over an orchard nearby. That's a local effect. The fog you see on the coast is the warmer Pacific air moving over the Pacific upwelling, which is colder air, which is there because of the rotation of the Earth. So that doesn't change. And so the warmer air, which can hold more water vapor in vapor form, passes over a colder band of moisture. It suddenly drops in temperature. So now it can't hold as much water in vapor form. You get suspended droplets. That's why you get fog along the coast basically every day, practically year round. So that's a different origin. They can be equally dense, that's for sure. And people who moved to this area 50 years ago were quite accustomed to tule fogs, ground fogs, as we call them. Tules refers to the tule reeds or cattails that are in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, where we basically live. They were very characteristic over the tules. Mostly those are gone. Mostly they've been turned into agriculture and housing and whatnot, but the conditions still remain. Tule fog was a very local phenomenon. And if you moved here that long ago, you knew that there were days in December and into early January, typically, where it was very unsafe to drive. Nights, I should say, more than days, literally 10, 20, 30 foot visibility as you're driving. It is well established that the tule fogs, the ground fogs, have largely significantly diminished, largely gone away. People new to the area experience fog a few times in the winter. I remember in the 80s, one spell when we went 15 days without seeing the sun. You would get ground fog in the morning, tule fog so dense that you couldn't see. It would rise, but it wouldn't dissipate. It would just rise and form a ceiling over you. And gradually, those ground fogs from all around the area would coalesce. And we would call that the valley fog. And people above us in the foothills could look down on this giant bowl of soup of fog where we were, and they were above it. They were up in the sunshine. You could go either direction, east or west, and get up and out of the fog, but that just doesn't happen anymore. And there's two primary reasons. One would be the indirect effect of climate change, with night temperatures increasing slowly but steadily. And as the temperature goes up, the air can hold more of the water in vapor form and less as visible suspended droplets of water. So you'd be less likely to see the fog. The other is simply that the air has gotten cleaner. And when you take away the particulate matter that was suspended in the air, the tiny dust particles and things like that, fog begins, as does frost, by coalescing around suspended particles. And so the fog was likelier in a place where you'd have not just dust from agricultural operations and smoke from the fires that occurred here naturally, as well as from agricultural burn, but also tailpipe emissions from cars. And we have significantly cleaned those up in the last 50 years in California. So there's less pollution to lead to fog. So those are multiple factors, but it's well established that as of over a decade ago, the incidence of valley fog had dropped by more than 30%. And it's more than that now. So the fog is basically going away. The one implication of that that gardeners or particularly farmers should be a little bit concerned about, it means we have more sunny days in the winter. Okay, that sounds like a great thing to you and me, but it undoes some of those chilling hours I was talking about. So if we have a day in the 70s or even in the mid 60s in the winter, it reduces the efficacy of the previously accumulated chilling hours.
Oh, and the dense fog that they're talking about today and tomorrow, is that tule fog? Or it's certainly not ocean fog.
No, it's tule fog. Yeah, it's ground fog. Ground fog. It's probably easier if we could just call it a radiation fog or a ground fog. Okay. Nobody knows what tules are anymore. Okay,
I do. It's a place where the red-winged blackbirds hang out and nest.
Yeah, cattails. I mean, they're great giant reeds. And when people came through here in the mid-19th century, when people were coming through to go to the gold rush, you can go back and you can find journals and you can also find paintings and maps. They basically showed Yolo and Solano counties as a giant marsh. That's pretty much all they saw as they were passing through from the Bay Area over to the gold country. Yolo County and Solano County, the railroad tracks took the path of least resistance. So pretty much they looked out at giant what looked like grasslands, reeds in all directions. There was really rich soil further in towards the coast range that winters in places like that. Place where my farm is, for example, were grasslands, not tule marshes. Speaking of which, we have a PSA.
We actually do. And this one I found interesting. I've never heard of these folks before. California Native Grasslands Association.
Wasn't that a great segue? We rarely do a lead in that effectively.
And it was by accident, too. So CNGA, it works to promote, preserve, and restore the diversity of California's native grasses through education, advocacy, research, and stewardship. For more information, visit cnga.org. And the reason I wanted to say this today is that if you look at their website, the registration is now open for their February symposium. Okay. I encourage you to go and look at the website and see what these folks are all about.
Yeah, why would you need to preserve grassland, quote unquote? I see grasses all over the place here.
Yeah, but they're not our grasses.
Yeah, they are adventive grasses, is the term that I learned when I was in college. Adventive, you can say invasive if you prefer, but adventive simply means they came into the area. They're not native here. Most of the golden grasses that you see, the golden rolling hills of California, that great song by Kate Wolfe. It's oats, barley, which are not native here. We do have a lot of cool grasses here. Check it out. We also have great programming here at KDRT, and there's been a couple schedule changes. We have several new programmers that have come on. This is great. I urge you to go over to kdrt.org and click on the schedule guide. And I was over there looking, and Lois said, "Oh, my show has moved."
Surprise. Okay. So from now forward, look for me, listen to me, noon on Wednesday. And that's Life is the name of my show. And then noon on Thursday, of course, this show, the Davis Garden Show, is. So we're now both at noon, Wednesday and Thursday.
Look what happens on Thursday. You can listen to Sound So Sweet with Wayne Hagen, which is jug band music, at 10 a.m. And then 11, one of the new shows, Grist for the Chill, which is a great program. That's before the Davis Garden Show on Thursday. So things have moved around a little bit. Davis Garden Show remains where it is. That's Life is now Wednesdays at noon.
Okay, let's get back to questions. Oh, hey, I had an excitement, Don. I have this bird bath just outside my kitchen window, and the hermit thrush is back for the winter.
Is it called a hermit thrush because it lives alone?
They're not. They don't hang out in flocks.
So it lives alone.
Last year we had
It's an old guy who lives alone, comes back.
No. It's just they aren't flocking birds. They're right. Just ones or twos.
They're introverts. All right. Speaking of birds, we got something in the email bag here about birds. Why don't you go ahead? And this is your department primarily, although I think we overlap on this one. Go ahead.
I think so. Hi, Don. Hi, Lois. My wife and I have concerns regarding a growing charm. That's the group affiliation for hummingbirds. A growing charm of 20 to 25 hummingbirds. Whoa. Encouraged to hang out in our yard by our planting of numerous hummingbird attracting plants and, for the past 2 years, by putting out an increasing number of feeders for them. We now have 8 feeders. That's 17 spigots, little holes. 8 feeders. As committed listeners to the Davis Garden Show, we know that you, Lois, are bird aware and bird savvy, so we are directing our concerns to you. 1, regarding pollination. The birds are literally always from 6:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. sitting on their feeder perches, gulping away. They currently knock back 2 quarts of elixir per day. Well, that's for 8 feeders. You know, that's not too bad. Yeah. With that convenience going on, do they stop visiting flowers for nectar because they no longer have a need to? By providing them all they can drink, are we contributing to a crop failure next year? We have peaches, plums, and pomegranates near where they feed. Their favorite hangout is in a Santa Rosa plum tree adjacent to the feeders. Okay, so, Don, my first question to you is, peaches and plums, aren't those flat flowers? Would hummingbirds even pollinate those?
They would visit them probably for one reason or another, but they're not a primary pollinator of any crop that I'm aware of. I mean, they're not even a secondary pollinator. Peaches, plums, and pomegranates are bee pollinated, primarily the European honeybee, but you will see other bees visiting them. I certainly see the Xylocopa or carpenter bees visiting pomegranate flowers when they come out later in the season. Blue orchard bees, which are native here, other types of bees that are native will visit those. I would have no concern about those particular crops or really anything, because well, hummingbirds, you know, I'm not a hummingbird expert, but well, they are pollinators. That's not their primary thing. We don't count on them to make our crop of jujubes or plums or anything like that. So I'm not concerned about that aspect of this whatsoever. Yes, you will see them visiting, you know, just my own experience as with yours, visiting almost every kind of flower. And you'll notice that they go to all kinds of flowers, but they keep going back to certain ones. Not because they're pollinating them, but presumably there's a nectar reward or there's bugs or something there. A lot of people don't seem to know that hummingbirds eat bugs.
So if you see a hummingbird that has a light dusting of yellow on its forehead, yes, you know that it has gone to some place where the flower is big enough that it can stick its entire head in there.
Yes,
and that's very unusual.
Yeah, the pollen got there by accident. And that's true. Pollination is, you know, a passive activity from the flower's viewpoint. You watch, for example, bees and things going into salvia flowers. There's a little trip mechanism up at the top of the salvia flower that deposits pollen on the back of a bee, because the bee snuggles right down in there and it comes down and it puts the pollen on the back of the bee without the bee even being aware of it, of course. In the case of a hummingbird, that wouldn't be terribly efficient, but it probably happens. However, I'm not concerned about them as a pollinator for your fruit crops whatsoever. We always hear these rules, you know, plant this kind of flower and that kind of flower and this color flower and that color flower. You and I have both observed, yes, they go to those. They certainly go to tubular flowers and they hang out at them a lot. They also go to all kinds of other flowers and a whole lot of flowers that, if you look closely, are in fact tubular, although perhaps flattened, like lantana and verbena and things like that. And again, I watch them go to every kind of thing that's open out there. Why? Because there's nothing much out there. You know, the percentage of things in your yard blooming is much lower in December, January. I'll see them go to dianthus and cyclamen. I don't think there's any nectar reward in a cyclamen flower for them. They're just trying it out. But then you start watching what they go back to. If you really want to draw hummingbirds, watch the ones they're going back to. Abutilon, for example, and then just plant more of them. However, that's getting off topic. Go ahead.
So I want to speak to that tubularness.
Yeah.
One of the things to think about is that it may be that other nectar feeders are not able to get into the tubular flowers where the hummingbirds can. And so if nobody else has been stealing the nectar, then it's there when the hummingbird comes by. So that may be why people have this tubular flower fixation.
Interesting side note on that is if you watch flowers like salvias in particular, you'll see you use the term stealing the nectar. There are Xylocopa bees in particular, the big black carpenter bees. They come along, they land on the side of the flower, they push their proboscis or whatever through the side to steal the nectar without even going through the tube. So
they're not pollinating anything.
That's right. They're bypassing the whole mechanism. Anyway. All right. That's off topic. Back to the second question.
Okay. So Andrew's second question is regarding vacations and costs.
Right.
All right. Our second concern is how to scale back the size of the charm. We spend about $50 per month on sugar. Plus, we cannot leave the birds unattended for more than 2 to 3 hours as they run out of elixir. We call it nectar, by the way.
Elixir sounds good to me.
Yeah, it does. We dare not contemplate a vacation without finding someone willing to come over 4 times a day every day while we're gone. We're worried that by virtue of our care of the birds, that they have been able to breed more successfully and have now established a population that exceeds the carrying capacity of their environment without feeders. We do not want to harm any of the birds by too quickly reducing their available elixir. Is there a safe way to wean them from the feeders and back into their natural sources of nutrition, that is flower nectar and baguettes? Thank you for what information you can share. Wonderful show, the Davis Garden Show. Davis is most fortunate to have you both on the air. Well, thank you for the compliment. Now,
I love the term baguette, by the way.
Well, there's hummingbirds are small birds. They're not going to eat a bee.
Well, it will come
they'll eat an aphid.
Yeah, and parts of the and little tiny things on there. I mean, most people don't know that they eat bugs, and actually, I don't know if they're an important part of aphid control, but they're just another thing eating the aphids for you. And there's a lot of things that do.
So, one thing to think about is the cycle of the bird. So in the wintertime, it is true that there are fewer flowers than there are in the summertime. That's definitely true. And so the fact that you have your garden planted with hummingbird attracting plants is great, especially if you have something blooming in the winter. So that's one thing. And then the next is, when do they nest? When are they raising babies? When are they needing that extra energy? Well, the earliest known nesting behavior in our area is January 1st.
Earliest by the calendar? It couldn't be any
The
earlier.
calendar. Yes, that's right. So in January, think about those little hummingbirds, and they've made a nest. The nest, by the way, is the size of a dime,
Oh,
the
okay.
tiny.
Yeah. How big is a hummingbird egg?
Yeah, less than that.
I'm holding up my fingers the size of a pea. Okay.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It's basically the nest. You want the hummingbird belly to cover the top of the nest and keep it warm.
Okay, that doesn't have to be
So
very big then,
it
no.
doesn't have to be very big, no.
Yeah.
And you will probably never see a hummingbird nest because they're so small and they're made out of lichens and spiders webs and little tiny things. So you probably will never see it. But if you ever do, that's what they are. Okay, so imagine a hummingbird. The female sits in the nest, the male doesn't. So the female's on the nest. Now, oh, we got babies. Hey, we got babies. Now we got to feed those babies.
Yeah.
Well, hummingbirds like nectar. They do. But it's really hard to carry home a straw full of nectar and shove it down a baby's throat. It doesn't work. So this is the time when the hummingbirds go for bugs a lot. They need
Okay.
a lot of protein and they have to feed the babies. And you can't feed them nectar, so you're feeding the babies the protein. And then the babies are growing like crazy, and eventually they get out of the nest and you got more charming hummingbirds or more hummingbirds in your charm.
So they shift over to higher protein then,
There
intentionally or inadvertently.
is not a higher, oh, okay.
Insects have more
But
protein.
bugs are protein.
Yes.
That's so
Bugs
they're
have protein.
yeah, so they're eating bugs.
Okay.
That's what it is. And then once the little ones can fly, then everybody can go and get nectar.
So the
And
way
that's
that Andrew should
great.
look at this is this buffet of sugar solution that he's putting out is a nice bonus. It's not the prime.
Well,
Probably not the primary food source for the hummingbirds.
it is the primary food source for the hummingbirds when they're not trying to feed the babies.
Ah, okay.
So during baby feeding time, the parents need the nectar to keep themselves going, but then they use the bugs to get the babies grown.
And for those who might be concerned that in the winter there isn't a good supply of bugs, go look at your
There is.
brassicas. Go
Yeah,
look at
there
your
is.
broccoli. Yeah,
There
I
is
mean
fine.
There are winter insects. I mean, we have the other end of this conversation with people who are coming in. Oh, we had a really bad caterpillar problem on this, that, mostly the brassicas, as we, because of the particular caterpillar. Oh, we got a lot of aphids on this. I said, well, the good news is those are slowing way down. So in terms of pest damage to your crops, those are going not going away, but they're not nearly as active. Once we get into the 30s at night and the daytime is in the 50s, caterpillars are cold-blooded. They can't do anything. They just hang there, as do the aphids. And they're not multiplying very much, but they're still present. They're still there. And if you look closely, you'll find some of them have been parasitized. Some of them are just hanging out feeding. There's enough food, I would have to say, in terms of insect availability for the hummingbirds to feed their babies. I don't think Andrew has anything to be concerned about in terms of affecting the population, but then the question is backing off.
Okay, hummingbird feeders are for the human beings. They're for us to enjoy those beautiful little birds. And if you put that humming feeder 2 feet away from your window, oh my goodness, you can stand there and watch them forever. I have one outside my kitchen window and makes it a real joy to wash dishes.
But
She's
I guess the concern he has is that he's
so.
affecting the population or would affect the population if he backed off. Yeah.
All right, so affecting the population. Let's deal with that one first. These little things fly, man. If suddenly their favorite bush got cut down and there were no more flowers there, well, they'd just go to the neighbor's yard and check out what they have. You know, they're coming to your place because the place exists as a really cool place to hang out. But if that place wasn't there, the hummingbirds wouldn't fall over and die. They'd just go find someplace else to get fed. So worrying about if I weren't doing this, would it harm them? It might irritate somebody. I wouldn't take the things away in the wintertime, because if you've provided this for a while, they know they can count on it and they've got babies. It would stress things out a little bit if that suddenly disappeared.
You don't want stressed hummingbirds. They get angry.
Yeah. And it's not good for the kids.
Correct. There you go. So
so if you're planning on reducing your hummingbirds, and 8 is an awful lot of hummingbird feeders. I mean, I thought we were had gone crazy. We've got 4.
Now, my mother went this direction, and pretty soon you had lots, especially in San Diego, you had lots and lots of hummingbirds coming around.
Only because they found the spot.
Yeah. So as long as you keep, here's the thing, in our area, you can keep flowering plants going out there. I still have Fuchsia triphylla, usually sold under the name Gartenmeister Bonstead years ago. It's the long tubular flower of fuchsia. Mine is blooming beautifully right now, and it typically goes through the winter. Some of my salvias continue through the winter. Abutilon, even though the plants can look a little stressed by the cold, they keep initiating flowers. So we live in a place where you can have flowers that are not only attracting them, but providing them with a known food source, like fuchsias. There are, of course, a lot of people listening in places where perhaps there's snow on the ground or things are freezing. So your options for flowering plants have gone away. Well, in those places, I'm not a bird expert, but my understanding is the hummingbirds have also gone away in those places. Right. They're migratory.
Hummingbirds and snow do not mix.
Yeah, not much for them to feed on there, even if you hang feeders out. But they, you know, think about how far they fly. This is the other thing. They're strong flyers. They're flying from Connecticut to Central America. So they do need a lot of food to do that, a lot of calories to do that, but they are very strong flyers. So if you don't have something in your neighborhood, someone 5 blocks away may be feeding the very same hummingbirds you're feeding, for all you know.
So as far as deciding to cut back, I would say that if you're going out 4 times a day, that's a little much. Now, I mean, if you want to do it, it's okay. Yeah. But so what I would do, instead of having 8 things, I'd cut it back to just the ones that are right outside the windows where you want to see them. So maybe 3 or 4, maybe. Yeah. And then make sure you have things where the sugar water, the nectar is, there's enough nectar in it to hold you for a couple of days.
There you go.
So you might get a different style of hummingbird feeder. If you go to my website, birdingwithlois.global, and you look at the hummingbird videos there, you'll see the kind of feeder that we use. And it's a large capacity. So we don't have to fill it up too often. Our problem mostly is in the summertime, is you want to make sure to change it more frequently than it will get things growing in it because of the heat. Stopping or reducing, don't let one just run out and hang there empty.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that. I would say, okay, when it gets empty, I'll take that one away.
Another point here is that for those of you dealing with aphids on some of your vegetables and flowers, spraying them with anything to control the aphids would be undesirable in this situation. No. And they're not really hurting most of your winter vegetables. And I understand you go out and you look at your broccoli and there's aphids on the undersides of the leaves and you're concerned about it. As you get closer to harvesting the broccoli itself, you may wish to vigorously rinse that to get things off of there. But if you're spraying, even with things that are considered benign, like neem, I would think, since neem acts as a repellent, it would probably repel the hummingbirds. It would be better, if you possibly can, to just leave those pests on there, monitor them if they're not stressing the plant particularly. And I never personally see the aphids on my winter brassicas and other vegetables get severe enough to do any real harm to the plant. I don't see them get out of hand because there's things that are naturally controlling them and their reproductive rate goes way, way down in the cold weather. Just leave them alone. Don't spray them with anything, even something that is being sold to you as benign, organic, and safe. That refers to you. And not to a little tiny, how much does a hummingbird weigh?
Oh, I don't know.
Not very much, but they would probably be repelled by neem. And of course, if you control the aphids completely, which would be surprising, you'd be taking away a food source. So I would suggest with all the winter vegetables that you'd not be particularly concerned about the pests, the small pests that are out there. Those aren't the ones giving us trouble right now. The pests that are giving us trouble right now are
caterpillars, and they're too big for a hummingbird to eat.
And they're also slowing way down. I mean, their damage has basically stopped in the last 3 to 4 weeks. And of course, white-crowned sparrows, and are having a lot of.
Now that's not for your brassica. That's for sprouts.
They go on anything if it's young enough. So we just suggest covering them over with some wire mesh. But that's a different issue. The main thing is going out and spraying a pesticide on your vegetables and your flowers in the wintertime is taking away a food source and could possibly even be doing some injury to the hummingbirds. All right, Andrew, thanks for the question.
It's not the end of our show, but I do want to add this saying that I found from the Organic Gardening magazine. Right. The only two herbicides we recommend are cultivation and mulch.
Yes.
And I would add water.
Mechanical control, yes. All right, next question.
Let's finish this off, though, by saying that if you go away on a vacation and you don't have someone to come over and do your hummingbird thing, just take them in.
Oh yeah. Okay. Clean them out. Take them down, clean them out, and they'll find them when you come back.
And when you put them back out, oh, they'll be back. And you know, hummingbirds are very persistent. They will come to something that used to be there and the something's gone and they'll go away. But you know, every month or so, they'll come and check it out. Is that bush regrown? Oh, there's our perpetual flower again. Oh, good. So yeah. Hummingbirds, once they've found a spot, they'll come back and check it out.
And they seem to have pretty good eyesight because I've watched them zooming over, you know, way up high and then bomb down to a little flower that I could barely see even at, you know, at my level. They're very good at seeking out. I do think that the color recommendations that we've read for so many years, I don't think they're completely accurate. You must use red or blue, but you know, you use the colors that they're likelier to see. And certainly red would stand out. I'm told that blue and violet colors appear to them very similar. Just, you know, I have noticed myself, and I did this test with Phygelius, Cape fuchsia. It's a plant from South Africa. And first it came out in a bright burgundy red, and then there was a lighter pink, and then there was a white one, almost white. It was pale, pale, pale yellow. I had them all in my backyard, and I'd watch hummingbirds go to them, and they definitely went to the white one less than the other two. They eventually went to it. They didn't not go to it, but they went straight to the red one, tested the pink one, back and forth between those, and then eventually would go over and sample that, as well as every other flower that was back there. So, you know, there may be something to the brighter color, but we don't see things on the same spectrum they do, apparently. So that's another issue.
That's something that listeners might want to go look up, is what range of colors are these hummingbirds able to see?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting one. I want to clarify something that you said. When they go way up high and they zoom down,
yes,
that's a mating ritual.
Ooh.
It is showing off. He's showing off for her. And different species have different patterns of that zoom. And some of them have their wings or their tails vibrate at the bottom. And so they add a sound to that zoom. It's really interesting. Again, listeners, hey, go check it out. Go read up on it. Go to Cornell University's ornithology place. And it is incredibly interesting. Hummingbirds are so cool. Thank you, Andrew, for sharing your question with us.
And the one hummingbird that I know overwinters here is the Anna's hummingbird, but you've mentioned two others.
Black chin hummingbirds are also resident. And then we have some that they migrate, but some of the migratory birds seem to think, well, maybe I won't go to Mexico this year. I'll just hang out in Davis.
Why bother? There's a guy over here putting out 2 quarts of sugar solution every day. Hope that answered your questions there. Thank you, Andrew, for the note. Okay, that was a lot about hummingbirds. They're always an interesting topic here, and we love to talk about hummingbird flowers, hummingbird feeders, all that kind of stuff. So here's the other thing, without regard to what we just said. If you're listening in other areas, you know, I know that there's people listening in places all over the world. Well, of course, some of you don't have hummingbirds at all, so
that's right.
About that. But if you are elsewhere in the United States, we would get these articles coming around in our Facebook feed periodically saying, all right, it's time to take down your hummingbird feeder, clean it out, put it away for the season.
And that's because they have snow in the winter.
I'm sure there's
hummingbirds aren't going to be there in the snow.
I assume not. Yes. I mean, I don't know, but I would assume that they fly. They have good sense to fly someplace warmer. So, yes, that would be accurate. But we just want people locally to know we have hummingbirds that appreciate your food during the winter as well.
Yes. Okay, let's go into questions that have come in. Well, the first one I want to talk about is the structure of fruit trees. Now, I know we can't get into in-depth on this, but I know that apical dominance means that the topmost growing point on something is exuding something that suppresses the buds lower down from opening up. And so the apex is dominant. Now, what is that thing that is putting out a chemical, a juice? What is it?
It's a hormone. Just like hormone. People have hormones, it's a hormone. And I found a great quote, and I don't know who wrote this for Wikipedia, but kudos to them for this great summary. Quote, without hormonal regulation and organization, plants would be merely proliferating heaps of similar cells. Okay. So hormones in plants, okay. And the one you're referring to that's coming from the apical bud, the highest bud on the woody plant. You mentioned fruit trees, so they're a good start, but this goes for, you know, shade trees,
but let's talk Christmas about
trees and all that. Hormones control the differentiation of the cells, how a otherwise undifferentiated cell becomes part of an organ. So they direct the growth of the plant organs, the leaves, the roots, the stems, the flowers, and ultimately, because of that, they control the shape and form of the plant itself. And the most important one, arguably, is the first one that was discovered, which are the auxins. A-U-X-I-N, not like the animal, not those kind of auxin. Auxins are extremely important, and that's what's exuding from and moving down from the very top bud on the plant. I'm oversimplifying. If there's a plant physiologist out there listening, wishes to send corrections or details, by all means, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. But auxins go down and suppress the growth of buds below them. So the topmost bud on the plant completely controls the buds below. Simultaneously, hormones are being created in the roots, cytokinins, which go up. And the interaction of auxins and cytokinins, which are important plant hormones, two of the five or six that have been identified, actually seven or eight, they regulate the differentiation, growth, cell division, and all that kind of stuff. So the answer to your question, the simple answer is it's hormones, just like in people. And the one that matters coming down from the top are auxins.
Okay. Now, apical, auxins coming down. Does that apical bud put out auxins all the time, or is it seasonal, or what?
It is seasonal because the growth terminates in mid to late summer on, we're talking woody plants, fruit trees, deciduous
fruit trees, and
conifers for that matter. The growth terminates and a new bud is formed that's ready to go for next year. And at that point, all the growth stops. So I don't know whether it continues to put down auxins or not. The plant has gone into a resting period. In fruit trees, I learned that period as being the quiescent period, and it's not a true dormancy. But then an important aspect of that, and I want to keep pulling this back to home gardeners. If you go out to your peach tree and it's flushing out all this new growth and that shoot is going straight up and it's June and you go, I'm going to prune this, and you prune it, where you cut, it will immediately sprout because you've taken away the suppressive influence of that growing point. If you wait until August or September and cut it, it won't sprout. So the plant is functionally dormant at that time, even though it still has leaves on it. So that's the home garden aspect of this.
Okay, so I've got lots of little questions. So short things. Now, are all of the buds below the top suppressed? And so if I look at a branch and I see buds on the side, some are leaf buds, some are fruit buds, some are going to be a branch. Are all of those buds suppressed?
All the growth buds are up to a point. That varies from one species to another. That's why some trees have different shapes than others. The effect is not consistent across species or even within mutants within species. But in general, it is suppressing all of them. It's less suppressive as you get further down. So some trees take on one type of growth habit. Some trees take on another type of growth habit, depending on how much it suppresses those buds. getting back to those two hormones, the one coming up from below, cytokinin, has some functions similar to the ones coming down from above. And one of the things that cytokinins do is they initiate lateral growth. And so if you've got a plant that's suppressing its buds, but not super strong, it may get a more broad-based habit because of the influence of the other hormone. And the interplay of those hormones is complicated.
Okay, so is the bud already in existence and it's just being suppressed not to open? Yes. Or is the undifferentiated cells not making a bud?
The answer to your first question is yes.
Yes, okay. So why doesn't it stop fruit from happening or flowers from happening?
Why?
Well, you said it suppresses the growth of buds.
Growth, but not necessarily the division within the bud. Cell division is occurring in buds. If you cut into a bud, there's all kinds of stuff already differentiated in there, ready to expand. Mm-hmm. And that continues. Differentiation and cell division continues. It's the growth and the expression that doesn't.
Okay. So now you said if you cut off the tip, you've removed the auxin, and all the buds below that will suddenly grow.
Many of them will, not all of them, and it depends on their placement as to what will happen. But this is super important because you can actually seriously damage, injure, affect. Let's use affect. Let's use a neutral term. You can seriously affect the habit of the tree when you take out that central leader, which we always do with fruit trees, by the way. You never let it grow with a central leader. You're doing that for a bunch of reasons. A bunch of the buds below will immediately be released from their bondage, and they will try to grow. You can then have a real problem. If they all grow, then you've got a bushy plant. And that's how, by the way, most people grow their fruit trees. They let those grow and then they control them individually. So you're turning your tree, if you will, into a shrub. I realize I should be careful about using those terms because there's much confusion. But the other thing that can happen is, and this happened to a conifer on my property, you lose the central leader, two will quickly replace it. And on conifers, this almost always happens. A new leader almost always forms immediately. Well, sometimes two form and they're conjoined. In other words, they're both growing at the same rate. I had an incense cedar that I planted in the mid-1980s. And 10 years ago, I looked at it and I saw, oh, I've got a double leader there. I've got conjoined. That's not good. But I didn't do anything about it. I needed to get someone up 30 feet up there to just take one of them out. That's all I needed to do. Okay, I love to tell you about my mistakes because then you won't make the same mistakes.
Actually, I did.
Yes, and then I'm looking at it a few years ago and I realize, oh, now they've split about a foot apart. I go, okay, I've got a problem because it's now the tree is now going to split somewhere and I don't know how far down that split goes. So I had a guy come out who was a certified arborist. He got up there and we had decided we were going to take it out if that was what was necessary. And he found it had split all the way down to the ground. 30-foot tall tree was already split. It just didn't appear to be fully split. So the next major storm was going to bring it down on its own. So I decided to have it come down on my terms, not nature's terms. And I paid him to take it out. But that was my mistake. I could have corrected that. But what I had allowed to happen was a conjoined leader. Two buds that broke and grew at the same pace. Usually one of them will outpace the other. That hormonal effect of auxin is very strong. Yeah, and so normally one will, but you know, if you're a tree guy, you should watch for these things because we're professionals, right?
But auxins go down. Oh, so if the two are side by side, then neither one of them is going to affect the other because neither of them is below the other.
Eventually one typically will, but not always. Yeah.
So I had a similar situation, though I didn't know it was a problem. Mm-hmm. There was a redwood tree and it had way up at the tippy top. It had, as you said, become a double leader. Mm-hmm. And then I had a pine tree that was it was a Christmas tree that the previous owners had the landscapers cut every year to the same size and shape. The poor little thing. When I let it go and didn't stop pruning it, it shot up, but it ended up with a double header and I did not realize it. And so one storm, nice broad storm, and it took out both of those. It took out the top of the redwood and it took out the top of the pine tree. Well, the pine tree was down far enough that I could get somebody up there to trim it up a little bit and get the ripped parts off. But and then we just let it go. And the redwood was so tall, I just said, well, it's going to do what it's going to do. And it ended up with one leader now, and it's fine.
Now, we've been talking inadvertently about conifers, so we are talking about the growth shape that's affected, you know, that's created by the impact of these hormones. There's X current and D current forms. Basically, trees are more or less grouped into those. I found another great quote here, so we're just going to give you someone else's quote. This is from a blog called awkwardbotany.com. Awkwardbotany.com. In the book The Tree, Colin Tudge, he's got to be British, defines a tree as a big plant with a stick up the middle. Sometimes this stick runs straight up from the ground to the top of the tree without interruption and is the tallest portion of the plant. Other times the stick reaches a certain height and branches out into multiple sticks, each one reaching out in a different direction, some heading more outward, others continue to reach for the sky. That's the difference between X current and D current growth. So we've talked about incense cedar, redwood, pine. Those are all was almost always X current. The shape like a Christmas tree is the easy way to remember it. D current is your broader, rounder crown. And all of our fruit trees, bringing it back to your original question, are D current. I can't think of off the top of my head of any truly X current fruit species, although the very narrow upright growth habit of apples and pears, when you first plant them and grow them, would lead in that direction. Something that can affect the growth habit of a tree is, aside from, you know, weather injury, wind storms, things like that, the weight of the fruit can literally change the shape of the tree. So if you plant a golden delicious tree, it will be X current if you do nothing. Most people do prune them for access to the fruit. But if you did nothing, it'd be very upright, very Christmas tree shaped at first, then gradually spreading, then forming more fruiting wood, which in the case of apples forms on very short spurs. And once you get a good crop year and on a lot of spurs, the weight of the fruit alone will actually change the shape of the tree. And I think that's the case of most members of Prunus, which is our plums and peaches and apricots and all that crowd. They start to set fruit. It actually increases the spread and reduces the likelihood of further vertical growth. So there's factors other than just the hormones that take place in the ultimate shape of the tree. And probably the biggest factor is what you do when you plant it. And for the first few years as you grow it and train it. I look at people's pictures all the time, bring in your picture, you know, especially in the winter, showing the silhouette of the tree. And I'm going to have you take a tree, even if it has a somewhat X current habit, and make it more D current, because I think you want to pick more of your fruit. And that's one of the main purposes of the pruning we do on fruit trees, even though it removes the controlling effect of those highest buds.
All right, so we have some questions to get to today. This one says, I have a Christmas cactus, zygocactus, at work, and it grows great, but it never blooms. Is it not in enough light? Does it need a special plant food? What's up with that?
It's an easy one, but most people don't go to the right answer right away because you haven't taken a course in plant physiology and studied photoperiod.
Can I answer this one?
Go for it.
Okay, so I think some cactuses... Well, they're not cactuses. Some zygocactus would benefit from being taken outside as the day lengths shift so that you're getting sunshine and nighttime and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, you're getting there. First of all, they are cactus. They are in the cactus family. They're unusual in that they're epiphytic tropical cactus. Most cactus that we think of are from the subtropics or from arid areas that are even further north than that. But these are true cactus. These actually hang out in parts of Brazil, and they live up in the rainforest, up in the canopy, not down on the ground. So you can grow them basically like orchids if you want to. Most people put them in a soil, and the soil should drain well. They can live for generations. I have seen pictures of 100-plus-year-old Christmas cactus, Thanksgiving cactus, holiday cactus, zygocactus. Those are all common names. Zygocactus used to be the botanical name. Now they're all considered to be Schlumbergeras. Hybrids in the genus Schlumbergera. And forever and ever, when I first went into the nursery business, there were zygocactus, which were Christmas and Thanksgiving cactus, which you can tell apart by a couple of methods that you can look up online. And then there were Easter cactus, which have a tubular flower, and the others are a flattened flower. So that part is easy. They've all been moved into Schlumbergera. There are complex hybridizations that have led to the ones that bloom around Thanksgiving and the ones that bloom around Christmas. They're slightly different, but they are tropical to subtropical. We have found they're as hardy as a jade plant. So we keep them outside. We keep, when we bring them in, we bring a bunch in for the holidays, we keep them outside up against the building where they get very bright light. because we find if you bring them in right from a greenhouse, they just start dropping flower buds right away. Yeah, there's still a lot that'll open, but they don't like that sudden shock. If you're listening to us outside of USDA Zone 9B, you probably should protect them in the winter because they can go down to 30, 31 degrees without injury, but much below that, you'll get pretty significant injury. What controls the blooming on them, as with poinsettias, as with chrysanthemums, they are short day plants. It is photoperiod. It's a chemical reaction in the plant in response to longer nights. Is actually, they call them short day plants, but we really should call them long night plants because it has to be a long night uninterrupted by any kind of light, including an incandescent light bulb, including, as at her workplace, the security lights that are on overnight in the building. So it never goes anytime indoors without light. And it can be just an incandescent light bulb. This isn't a grow light or a sunlight thing. It's any kind of light affects the phytochrome reaction in the plant. It essentially inhibits it. So the plant won't initiate flowers and bloom. So the simplest way in our area to grow your Christmas cactus, because they like bright light, is put them outside. When you're sheltered patio or your or the shade of a high tree, they're not great in full sun. Morning sun is okay. We put them on the east side of our building all through the spring, summer, into the fall. As we get to actually feeling like fall, they need to have uninterrupted darkness. But if you then bring them in, let's say mid to late October, they're already triggered to bloom. They will go ahead and bloom for the holidays, unless you happen to have a porch light right above them outside. So remember, any source of light, including your shop light, your front porch light, the incandescent light bulb in your living room, those break up the flowering reaction. The plant is fine. Plants are easy to grow. They don't require transplanting because they are a epiphytic thing that typically live with very small root systems. The only real reason most people transplant them is they become top heavy and they need more ballast. So they can grow for years and years and years in the same pot as long as you give them some plant food every now and then. And if you do transplant them, make sure it drains well. So cactus mix is usually ideal for them, but they do need that uninterrupted period of darkness, just as poinsettias do, starting in late summer, early fall, September, usually, in order to trigger the bloom.
So I've got two questions. What about if my plant was small enough, what about if I took a parrot cage and just put it over the thing with a towel over it?
Paper bag would do. Yes. Complete. You can put it in complete darkness every single day for 6 or 8 weeks. Yeah. As long as you remember to do that. I had a customer who did that with her poinsettia, and we had long arguments about why the poinsettia had died, because she thought it was because she had put it in the closet. And finally, after she'd gone on and on about this in some detail, her very sweet husband said, "Yes, Dorothy, but you left it in the closet." Okay, so that does not work.
So it does need light. Just yes. It's our day. So when I eat a banana, there are tiny little brown dots in it that I assume are seeds. Can we grow bananas from seed?
Not that one. The banana that you're eating is one of the strains of Cavendish banana. They are triploid. Those little tiny seeds that you see are sterile, so they will not grow. And that's 99% of the bananas that are grown for commercial purposes in the world are variants of Cavendish. Some of you have probably seen these articles that go around every so often about the current threat to the Cavendish banana. The disease that killed its predecessor is now attacking Cavendish bananas. And so agricultural scientists are working frantically. They always use that term, working frantically to find a replacement that's resistant to that particular Fusarium disease called Panama disease, which is really threatening the Cavendish population. Bananas that you buy in the store are all clonally propagated. You can easily do it by taking a root division. Commercially, I presume they use tissue culture to get large numbers more quickly, but they're all clones. And they are triploid. Now, if you want to make your head hurt, go to Wikipedia and read about the genus Musa and all the bananas. But just the edible ones, it's incredibly complicated. Some are diploid, some are tetraploid. The triploid ones, which are the Cavendish, are sterile, like a mule, like the marigolds that are triploid, like the Hibiscus syriacus, Rose of Sharon that are triploid. They don't truly set seed, or they don't set viable seed. There are bananas that have seed. Anyone who's traveled outside of the United States and gone to any of a number of countries around the world and gone into an actual produce market, as we would do in Baja California when I was a kid, will see a whole bunch of bananas on display, including, you know, the Chiquita Cavendish type, but also things that we call plantains, and also starchy bananas, which are usually often called plantain, and also sweet bananas, which are or sometimes called dessert bananas. Those are two and basic.
Apple, in Hawaii, it's apple bananas, and you have a small hand of.
There, that's one. And
Nugget Market has it.
There's about 500 to 1,000 varieties of bananas, and we in the world mostly eat one. That the others, some of them have seeds. Some of those tend to be very starchy, so you wouldn't think of them as being banana-like, but they're sweet, but they're also more starchy, and they're kind of astringent unless you cook them. So people need to know, and I remember my mother asking in this market, do we have to fry these? Because there's some that you can eat fresh and some that your simple practice is to take it, peel it, put it in a pan and fry it, saute it, if you will, enough to eliminate the astringency, bring out the natural sugar in it and make it edible at that point, or they're often used in recipes. So there are bananas that you can grow from seed, but the ones that you buy in the store in anywhere north of the Mexican border are almost certainly Cavendish bananas, unless you've gone to a specialty market, in which case you may have other options.
So this next question was a phone call that came into Don's store saying, I'm looking for the Cosmo Dwarf Apple. Well, the message said Cosmo Dwarf Apple.
Yes.
You figured out they meant Cosmic Crisp Apple on a dwarfing rootstock.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a new apple that was introduced, Washington State University. And this question comes up with a bunch of apples, Jazz Apple, this apple, that apple. This one is patented. It's licensed by Washington State University, only to be sold to people residing and growing the plants in the state of Washington. So the answer to your question, can I get it? No, I cannot get it.
You don't live in Washington.
I could drive to Washington and get one, I suppose. This came from a great resource, by the way, for those of you interested in things like this, Rain Tree Nursery. I go to their website all the time. They carry a lot of really unusual stuff. And they're in Washington State, so they can sell it. But they comment in capital letters, we cannot ship this tree to an address outside of Washington State. It's a new, red, juicy apple with a perfect combination of sweetness and tartness. The first release from the apple breeding program at Washington State. Well, thanks for selling it to us verbally, even though you can't sell it to us actually. But yeah, it's getting good ratings, and it's the kind of thing that it's being controlled. Budwood of certain apple varieties is controlled. You actually have to belong to guilds in some cases to get access to the budwood. This is a marketing thing. They have found that certain apples, well, I was just standing at the Nugget Market looking at their apple display. There are some apples there for $2.99 a pound. Some apples there for $4.99 a pound. The ones that are $4.99 a pound are these newer varieties. There's usually a sign over them explaining why they're so wonderful. And in those cases, those ones that are higher priced are typically controlling, the owner of the patent is typically controlling the budwood availability. In some cases, they literally license it to farmers rather than selling it to farmers, because that makes it possible to get a premium price for it.
You can send us garden quotes. And Jane has been kind enough to send one. We do a garden quote at the end of most shows. Gardening is the closest one can come to being present at creation.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.